Actor Jim Ridge thinks about Charles Dickens as a great social reformer masquerading as a storyteller. That's what drove him to work with his friend Jim DeVita to bring Dickens back for modern audiences to enjoy. After I had a chance to see their Dickens in America, I wanted to know more about the premise.
What if it's a public reading, but what if it's his last night? So here's this thing then that he fed off of. He loved being in front of his public, adored being able to perform. So this thing that fed his spirit, what if just hours ago he's decided that he can't do it anymore? So then that one performance becomes huge. It has huge ramifications for him.
So where do you start? What's the first scene? It's from Pickwick Papers?
The first scene is from, right, the Pickwick Papers. And we began with that one simply because we took this scene where Pickwick and his traveling companions meet.
Well, it has some opportunities for you as well, because it's an opportunity to leap into this with several voices.
Right, and that's why we picked it. He meets Jingles, and the four of them are then on top of this carriage rolling through the country, and Jingles just starts telling these outrageous stories, and the four companions become just enamored of this guy who seems to have traveled the world all over. And there was a chance automatically to have four or five voices right away. You know, you hit the audience, and again, the audience quickly catches on, or else they're lost for the entire night, that this is about one person presenting many voices, and the onus is really on the audience to engage their imagination if they're going to stay up with the evening, which is the best of theater in my mind, because then the audience can't sit back and sort of check themselves out of the equation of the evening. They have to be actively engaged. And if the audience's imagination is actively engaged, then they're automatically going to bring their own lives to it, and it becomes a personal night of storytelling for each person who walks through that door.
Well, can you give us just a little bit of one of Jingles' stories from the beginning, a sense of how it gets underway?
Sure. So Dickens is starting his introduction, and he says, "For often the path we choose to walk reveals itself a steeper climb than first we expected, but I take much comfort, for all of us, in the observation that in journeys, as in life, it is a great deal easier to go downhill than up."
"Up here! Mr. Pickwick, sir! On the carriage! Now watch your step there! Yes, thank you, but no, I insist. Friends too, room for all. Up on top, gentlemen. Now balance it out now. Is there not space enough inside the carriage? A wooden ear of it, sir. Only way to see the world, this. Only way. Sit down, gentlemen. Quick now. Archway coming. Heads. Take care of your heads. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo. Lovely way to travel, this, but dangerous. Dangerous work. Other day, five children, mother, tall lady, eating sandwiches. Forgot the arch. Crash, knock. Children look round, mother's head off, sandwich in her hand, no mouth to put it in. Head of a family off, shocking. Contemplating that, Mr. Pickwick, sir, eh? Contemplating that." And thus it begins.
You get grins right away on everybody's face.
Hopefully, yeah.
One of Dickens' great advantages was that he could paint pictures with words, the scenes that he saw come across. But it's a challenge, has to be a challenge for you. You've got two gentlemen right there at the beginning.
Right.
Almost three. You've got Dickens in two different characters. I mean, Dickens as Pickwick and Dickens as the lecturer.
Yeah, of course, doing it on the radio is one thing. It relies on inflection of voice and changing the timbre of the voice and the rhythms of the voice a little bit. And then again, the imagination of the audience then goes wild. On stage, we didn't want to change hats and put on a shawl and do that sort of thing. So it became gestural instead, so that I would come up with a single physical gesture that would get introduced right away with the character. That became a cue then for the audience that whenever I went back to that physical gesture, along with what I was doing vocally,
Dickens was back on stage, or...
Right, or, oh, that's whoever. Jingles again. Oh, you know, Mr. Pickwick always holds his ample tummy, you know, and that sort of thing. So,
yeah,
little clues for the audience.
So where did you go? You went through the main things that we know. Oliver Twist, mm-hmm. Great Expectations, Hard
right.
Times.
Right. He really gets to just get on a roll at first with the several selections. David Copperfield, he talks about himself as an actor, loving to be an actor. And then all of a sudden he goes into Hard Times, and there's this teacher, Mr. Gradgrind. And
I wish everybody could see the grin you get on your face when you say the names.
He was the first character that I fell in love with when I was working on this piece. Just a little bit of that. I sort of physicalized him a little bit like a vulture, you know, leaning over the front of the podium. But he's
girl number 20. I don't know that girl. Who is that girl? Sissy Jupes, sir, explained number 20, blushing. Sissy's not a name. Don't call yourself Sissy. Call yourself Cecilia.
But my father calls me Sissy, sir.
Then he has no business to do it. Tell me mustn't. Cecilia Jupe.
And he just goes on and on. He just is such an oppressive, awful character. And then at the end of that section, Dickens says, yes, Mr. Gradgrind, a man of facts and calculations with a rule and pair of scales always in his pocket, ready to weigh and measure any parcel of human nature and tell you exactly what it's worth. Would that he were merely a fiction. A society without imagination never did, never can, never will hold a great place under the sun. Without imagination, there is no compassion. And that then became the sort of the thesis statement for our entire night. Without imagination, there is no compassion. And so then he starts reading purposefully selections that have to do with that very thesis statement. He gets, you know, because it's the last night, he gets fired up again as though he's writing a brand new book. And who are these people who have all this power to make great significant change in the lives of people who have nothing? And all they do is get fat and feed each other and maintain their power and the status quo. That's awful. You know, that is the thing that keeps lighting that fuel under him time and time again.
So give me an example, another scene from Dickens in America.
Let's see.
I remember in seeing you do this that he seemed to talk about religion.
Yes.
Quite frequently.
Yeah, well, he gets into, right away in Oliver Twist, he's talking about, Oliver Twist was in a parish orphanage. So it was run by the church and the church board. And the parish beadle, Mr. Bumble, was a central figure in that. And yet the children who were in these places were starving. The very beginning of that. Although I am not disposed to maintain that being born in a workhouse is in itself the most enviable circumstance that can befall a human being, I do mean to say that it was the best thing that could have occurred for Oliver Twist. The fact is, there was considerable difficulty in inducing the infant Oliver to take upon him the office of respiration, and for some time he lay gasping on a little flock mattress, rather unequally poised between this world and the next. Now, if during this brief period Oliver had been surrounded by anxious aunts, experienced nurses, and doctors of profound wisdom, he would most inevitably have been killed in no time. And on and on. But he gets then to Mr. Bumble and this very famous scene of Oliver asking for more. Just another little tiny bowl of the most watery thin gruel, and all chaos breaks loose. You know, these adults are offended, mortally, morally offended, that one of their charges should dare to ask for more, to say that he was still hungry. And so here's a short section on Dickens getting a little fired up, but not being able to stop himself. When I completed Oliver Twist, I full expected it would be objected to on some very high moral grounds in some very high moral quarters. The result did not fail to prove the justice of my anticipations. Of these self-appointed standard-bearers of a morality, let me simply say that I have no respect for their opinion, good or bad, do not covet their approval, and do not write for their amusement. These insects of the hour, who raise their little hum and beat their wings, and die forgotten. I am waxing political. Forgive me. My doctors have warned me about that. Beg pardon, as Sam Weller said, but when I gets on this here grievance, I runs on like a new barrow with a wheel just greased. And yet, I satirize them not because I and the rest of mankind are devoid of such oppressive tendencies, but because the self-indulgence and lack of compassion in public figures directly influences the lives of so many innocents, the young, the old, the infirm. I learned as a mere boy to hold suspect those whose moral and religious beliefs conveniently coincide with their earthly goals. And then there are those of so refined and delicate a nature they cannot bear to contemplate the horrors of this world, and therefore feel that no one else should contemplate them either. I have no faith in the delicacy that cannot bear to look upon the truth. I myself have known what it is to have no hope. That is no matter. There is nothing delicate about poverty, or its causes, or the horrors which it breeds. And thus he begins his rant against hypocrisy, both institutional and religious.
So who, in the end, is your favorite of these? You get to be a dozen more characters. I know Dickens. Leave Dickens himself alone for a moment.
Yeah, he's such a wonderful man that I really did fall in love with him as I worked on this. But I think my favorite character is that Mr. Gradgrind. He's just so despicable. But certainly, we picked these pieces and settled on these pieces because each one spoke to something very particular in our world today and to our experience as artists. There's one section where the young David Copperfield talks about going to a play for the first time and falling in love with this world. You know, he talks about seeing, and there I saw Julius Caesar, to have all those noble Romans alive before me and walking in and out for my entertainment. You know, so he just is taken with this world where anything is possible.
Jim Ridge is presenting his one-man show, Dickens in America, in several venues in the Midwest. Jim is a member of the core company of American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin.